Evening. My name's Bob Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, what a privilege to be here tonight. I'd like to thank the committee for the awesome job for the roundup. It's absolutely wonderful. I'd also like to thank the committee for affording me the gift, the privilege, to stand before you and chat with you for a bit tonight. And it is, in fact, a privilege. My sobriety date is 8-8-88. It's a good date for my family. 8-8-88 is also my dad, my mom, and my sister's sobriety date. That should give you a tidbit of information how bad 8-7-88 sucked around our house. You know, it rolled right along, right? I hail from Redmond, Oregon. My home group's what's called 24 and Alive. So if you're ever up in central part of Oregon and in Redmond, stop by and see us. We'll give you a rousing discussion on Alcoholics Anonymous in one of our meetings and a nasty cup of coffee. That's what we got going for us, okay? But it's a great place to be. And wow, this is great. I'm a little bit intimidated, I got to tell you tonight. I've spoken a lot over the years, and wow, the sobriety in here, right? And I'm in a battle with lung cancer. And so if I have to step by and clear my throat a little bit, I don't have COVID, I'm not contagious, you know? It's just what I've got to do for a bit, right? But that's just what it is, right? Okay, I was raised in northern Idaho. Large German Catholic family. I had my dad and 12 uncles as male role models in my life. 10 of those 12 uncles were felons. 10 of those 12 uncles and my dad were alcoholics. They were nasty alcoholics. You never knew what dad was going to come home. Was it going to be the dad that was drinking beer and he'd be all sloppy drunk, you know, and he'd just smell, right? Or was it going to be the dad that switched over to whiskey somewhere along the line? His eyes were narrow and he'd come through and come up the driveway. We used to watch for him come up the driveway and see what his eyes looked like. Were they round or were they narrow, right? If they were narrow, when he hit home, he'd beat you with anything he could possibly beat you with. And so from a very early age, I have a baby sister. I remember hiding in the closet with a pillow over my sister's head so she couldn't hear what dad was doing to mom in the room next door. And I made myself some promises in that closet with my baby sister. I said, when I grow up, nobody was ever going to hurt me again. You know, when I grow up and if I ever have a little boy or a little girl, I'm going to love them to death. I'm not going to hurt them. I'm not going to do this to them, okay? I wish I could have kept those promises. You know, I wish I could have kept those promises. I'm an alcoholic. When I take that first drink, it demands a second drink. When I take that second drink, it demands me. And when it takes me, I have no idea where the hell I'm going or what I'm going to be doing at any given time. I just know that I'm a type of alcoholic that when I drink, the ones I love the most, I hurt the first and the worst. That's a hell of a thing to say, but it's absolutely true with me. You know, I'm a product of broken promises, broken dreams, and broken things. And I hate to even spit that out today, you know. But the fact of the matter is that's who I am. That's when I drink. So I was raised in northern Idaho. Naturally, northern Idaho, we're all farmers, ranchers, loggers, you know, a bunch of hillbillies, right? That's what it was to drink, you know? And to my family, if you didn't drink, the two uncles of mine that drank normally, I mean, we just ridiculed the hell out of them, you know? But the odd thing about it, as I reflect back, is those two uncles were different than us in more ways than just not drinking. They owned shit. You know, they had houses and boats and cars and all that stuff, right? They went to ball games with their kids. You know, they'd say, oh, I can only have one because, you know, I promised to take my wife somewhere. And we all looked at them like, you guys are fools. But that's who they were. That's who they were. But the rest of us, it was game on. You know, I'd just like to say that I'd like to tell you about one of my uncles. He was my role model. His name was Gordon. He was a Navy career guy, right? And he had, he'd come home on leave and he'd have new tattoos. And he had a big black panther on this arm. You know, the kind that had the claws out with the red ink on it that looked like blood. He had mother on this arm. And he'd come home and he'd be traveling all over the world in the Navy. He'd come home and we'd go up at big hunting camps with all of us guys and stuff, and he'd share stories. He had great stories, right, about being in the Philippines and all over the place. And I used to think, my God, would it be nice to be my Uncle Gordon. Now, he was a good-looking guy. He was dark-haired, chiseled jaw, muscles rippled, right? All the men were scared the hell out of him, you know, because he was tough. But he was good looking, and all the women loved him, you know. You women love a bad boy. He was a bad boy, right? And I used to wonder, what the hell are you doing, you know? He used to bring me things from all over the country, but he'd drink, and he'd fight, and he always got in trouble. And he'd leave and go back to his ship, and everybody was saying, one of these days somebody's going to kill him. One of these days he's going to drink himself to death, which he did. And I used to take such offense about that, because he was my hero. He was my Superman. You know, he was the guy that would sit down and talk to me. He was the guy that I'd ask, what are you doing in the Navy's for so long? And he had this big, tough, gruff voice. And he'd go, you know something, that's the only place in the world that I could go and have a fifth of whiskey in each hand, a hooker under each arm, and peeing in a fountain in Rome. I'd go, holy shit. I didn't know what a hooker was, but by God, I was going to get one. If it was good enough for Uncle Gordon, it was good. You know, I'm going to get me a couple six of those, you know. And, you know, I just led my life through that, just like him. I just followed Uncle Gordon. I just drank hard. You know, from the get-go, by the time I was 13, I was a full-blown alcoholic. I was one of those type of alcoholics that trouble follows me. I get caught. You know, I just get caught. By the time I was 13, I had my first arson charge. By the time I was 15, I had my second arson charge. By the time I was 17, I did an armed robbery and pulled the trigger. Luckily, I didn't hurt the guy with that. And by this time, the state of Idaho, I'd got tired of my crap. And so they gave me this little choice. They said, 2 years in Idaho. I just turned 18. 2 years in Idaho State or 4 years in the military. And they did that a lot back then. I took 4 years in the military. You know, got in some more trouble in the military because, once again, I drink, I get in trouble. You know, I can't stop it. It just seems like it follows me. Got sent to Vietnam, did 3.5 tours of duty in Vietnam. Came back and they put me in a mental institution for a year. Drinking all the way. Now, in Vietnam, when I was in Vietnam, and a lot of guys that are in the military here will know this one. We used to drink what's called Pink Lady. Pink Lady is a mixture of stuff that, as long as it's booze, we put in a coffee and drink it. We used to drink a lot of paint thinner in coffee and some engine degreaser and electronic degreaser called carbon tetrachloride. Came in 55-gallon drums. Paul apparently knows what I'm talking about, right? Anyway, we'd drink that stuff, right? We'd be out on the riverboats. And you had to watch each other, because if you drank too much of that stuff, especially the carbon tet, affected your optic nerves. And if we seen somebody blinking too much on the boat, we cut them off for 5 to 7 days, right? Their vision would come back, and then they'd start drinking again. Absolutely normal, you know? Absolutely normal. And anybody that didn't do that, they were something else, right? Anyway, I got in trouble over to Vietnam. They sent me back, stuck me in a psych ward for a year. Did that little shuffle, you know. I'm a good... The other thing in Vietnam, I discovered some other stuff other than alcohol that we won't talk about tonight. But it's just some other stuff, right? If I will say this, that if there was a toxic waste dump anonymous meeting, I'd be going to it. And I'm also a child of the 60s, which, you know, that we tested different chemicals along the way, we'll just say. But mainly I'm an alcoholic. And so I got out of the mental hospital. You know, I always excelled in what I did, too. Us alcoholics are pretty smart people. I mean, you sober us up for a while, and we do stuff. And I sobered up for a bit and made rank in the Navy, got selected to work for the Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, D.C. And I'd get ready to, I had to re-enlist to go back to Washington, D.C. I had 12 years in the Navy. And the captain on the ship said, you know something, Ray? You're going to have to clean up your act and sober up because you're a damn drunk. And nobody had ever called me a drunk before. Never. And I took really a lot of offense by it and decided to hell with you and I got other Navy. I was going to show him, you know. And that's what I do. I if somebody pins me against a wall, I cut and run. You know, that's the main thing to do. I go find some other people that drink just like I do, right? And we can sit around and be each other's victim. You know, sing that Who Done Me She Wrong song, you know. So I just kept drinking. Guy of the Navy kept drinking. Somewhere along the line, I picked up a wife. And we had a baby boy. And I do remember back in Portsmouth, Virginia, when that baby boy was born, I picked him up and held him, and I looked at him, and I thought that was the most precious thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. And I promised him. I looked at that little precious face, and I said, I'm going to love you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to treat you like I'd never had been treated in my life. Once again, I wish I could have kept those promises. Fact of the matter is that I'm an alcoholic. And alcohol is simply a symptom of my disease, right? And I found that out later on down the line that we'll get to. Anyway, we just, you know, I kept drinking, got out, moved to Portland, Oregon with my bride. And, you know, I quit drinking for a while. And once again, when I quit drinking, I could excel. Started a construction company in Portland, Oregon. It took right off, and I became, you know, pretty good success. Sit on a chamber of commerce, went to all these little business functions, right? And then I took that drink. And then I took that second drink. And then that second drink took me. And I destroyed everything I had built, including that marriage. And so I just kept right on going. I said, what the hell, if it's this bad now, I'm going to drink it to the bitter end. Now, I'll tell you that I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous a number of times, been into treatment a number of times, and it just never really was for me. Of course, I really don't know what was for me because I never tried any of it. My first 8 times in treatment in Alcoholics Anonymous, it went something like this. I'd go to an AA meeting, right? I'd look across the room, and there she was, the girl of my dreams, you know? I'd saunter over there. Somebody at one time, some lady told me that I had a deep, sexy voice. You don't tell somebody like me that crap. I'll use it like a weapon. And I'd saunter over across that room to there she was, and I'd drop my voice a little bit lower. And I'd use that famous AA pickup line. Can I buy you a cup of coffee later? She was just as sick as I was. She'd go, oh, sure, right? Next thing I knew, you know, she was my sponsor. I was hers. She was my higher power. I was hers. We became each other's drinking buddy, right? Wondering what in the hell happened. And so I just did that time and time and time again. I should have asked you, how long you want me to speak tonight? 35 minutes? Okay, anyway. Yeah, we just became each other's drinking buddies. And I'd sit back and I'd go, whoa.
So I just kept right on going, right? Kept right on cheating on my wife. Keep right on doing what I do, you know? And I'd come to AA to get my wife back. You know, AA was like running to mama when a bully was chasing you, you know? I'd dive in there and I'd promise her the moon, you know? I'm going to change this time. I got it now, right? And I'd look at the hope in her eyes and the glow in her face, and I'd look at that little baby boy that now was felt scooting around, and daddy's home, right? And daddy wasn't really home. It was just another scam. It was just another promise. It was just a bunch of the same old crap. And I'd go right back out and drink. I'm going to go right back out and do the same old stuff. Right back in another AA meeting. Right back in another treatment center, another detox center. Right back into, there she is, the woman of my dreams. And that's why I don't have almost 50 years of sobriety right now. Is that exact reason. So, kept drinking, kept getting in trouble, kept going to jail, right? And I came home one night, and I'd been out with the guys, had a few beers. And I walked in the house, and here my wife was sitting at the dinner table with what I perceived to be the meanest looking little lady I've ever seen in my life. And I walked over to my wife. My wife said, I'd like you to meet my new Al-Anon sponsor. And I said, hello, and I don't know what Al-Anon is, right? I just remember I said, I'm going to jump in the shower. Would you make me a sandwich? I'm going to go back and have a few beers with the guys. And my wife started to get up to make me a sandwich. And this mean little old lady grabbed her by the arm and pushed her down. And I thought, well, maybe this mean little old lady wants to make me a sandwich. I sure as hell never got a sandwich that night. And I go back to the bar, right? And clear down at the very end of the bar, there's this old fart that used to always drink in the same stool down at the very end of the bar. Bartender would say, no, don't take that stool. That's Earl's. And Earl was this little grumpy old fart, right? They'd go down at the end of the bar and snarl at everybody. And you'd walk up to him and go, how you doing today, Earl? None of your damn business. But that day, after meeting my wife's Al-Anon sponsor, I walked back in that bar. And I shared with my buddies that I just met my wife's Al-Anon sponsor. And old Earl turned around and yelled from the other end of the bar. He goes, you're screwed. And I go down to Earl, right? And I go, what do you mean? He says, get the hell away from me. So he left me with that, right? Now, you don't leave an alcoholic that's drinking that kind of information because, you know, I'm full of fear, right? I don't know what this Al-Anon sponsor is. I just know what happened on down the line is my wife became a real crappy housekeeper. And she started leaving this damn AA literature all over the place. And this blue book. You know, I had a blue book beside my bed, beside the toilet, beside my big chair. These pamphlets all over the damn place. And she'd go, I go, what the hell are these? And she'd go, read them, just look at them. And then it dawned on me. Her dad had a drinking problem and she wanted me to help him out. I thought, God, that's pretty nice of her. Shortly after that, I heard a knock on my door and these two guys, right? There's an old guy and there was a new guy, young guy. And they said, can we talk to you about your drinking? And I said, yeah, hell yes. You know, I got a whole cooler full back here. You know, I'm always ready to drink with somebody, right? And that old guy started to share about his drinking. And I started getting scared because he was talking about me. And then this young guy, real exuberant young man, slapped his hand down on my damn table, and he said, "You gotta find Jesus Christ." I thought, shit, Latter-day Saints. And I threw their asses out of there, right? I just know when I looked out the window, this old guy was just tearing this young guy a new one, right? I didn't realize at the time I was witnessing sponsee-sponsor relationship. You know? So I just kept on drinking. I pulled up in front of my house one day, and there my wife was. And she looked like, did a double take, and she looked like she was 100 years old. And she had my little boy standing right in front of her with her arms around him. And she said, "We need you to leave because you're killing us." And to this day, I remember looking down at my little boy, and he was staring straight ahead, and his eyes were as dead as the snakes, and his little lower lip was quivering. And he never said a word. And I went and packed my stuff, and I moved out to my dad and mom's, found another her, you know, and kept right on drinking. Kept right on drinking. And I told my dad several times along the way, I said, "You ever lay another hand on my mom, I'll kill you. I'm a mama's boy. I don't care what anybody says. I love my mama," right? And I said, I'll kill you if you do. And so I was going to AA, went back to AA, going to AA. I had 300 days sober, exactly, 10 months. And I was going to a meeting in this little town called Oregon City. And they used to have an old Alano club in there. That was one of the nastiest clubs I've ever seen. You know, smoke was like, you know, clear down, right? Nasty coffee. You could throw a softball clear across the room and it would stick on the wall from nicotine stains, right? And I was going there, right? But no sponsor, no God, no steps. Just a bunch of meetings because there are women in there. They'd say, "Why don't you come to our men's meeting tonight?" No. You know, that ain't happening. So I just kept going there, 300 days sober. I decided, you know something, there's a little cafe right down the block. On one side of it is a cafe, and the other side of it's a bar cafe. And they serve the greasiest, big old sloppy hamburgers you've ever seen in your life. And I go, "I'm going to stop in there right after this noon meeting and have one of those hamburgers." And I pulled in there and ordered one of those hamburgers and a Pepsi. And I'm sitting there enjoying my hamburger and Pepsi, and this guy comes in and plops his butt right next to me. And he orders a hamburger and a pounder. Now, this pounder was, it was a kind that was put in a freezer where it had ice, like a quarter inch thick, the glass all the way around it. And I'm drinking my Pepsi, and I'm glancing at that pounder, and drinking my Pepsi a little more, and I'm glancing at that pounder, and all of a sudden, that ice on that glass started to melt. And I swear it started talking to me. I said, "Bob, you got 300 days sober. You can have one. Bob, I taste really good. Bob, nobody will ever know." Right? The most dangerous thing in the world for me is Bob talking to Bob about Bob. I don't know if anybody else is that way, but, you know, when I do that, I'm talking to a nut. My sponsor used to tell me, he said, "You know, I'd like to be able to sell tickets to your brain because it's better than damn carnival." And that's true. I'm still that way. Anyway, this glass kept melting, and it kept talking to me. And I sit there, and I ordered one of them pounders. Because I convinced me, right? My alcoholism sitting on my shoulder convinced me. And I had one, and then I ordered a second one. And I drank that second one down, And that bartender come over and asked me the stupidest damn thing anybody could ever ask anyone. Do you want another? And I went, hell yes. And now I'm on a roll. 4 hours later, I was locked up in the county jail. You know, when I drink, shit happens fast. You know, I'm in jail. I get bailed out the next day. And go right to a bar. Get hammered. That was 8788. Went to that bar. Got hammered. Came home. Walked in the house. And my mom was out in the kitchen cooking. And I was talking to her. And she wouldn't turn around and look at me. And I walked over to her. And I put both my hands on her shoulders. And I turned her around. And she had a big red welt on the side of her face. And the last thing I remember her screaming at me, Bob, don't. And I woke up the next morning, and I walked out there, and Mom was on her knees out in the living room, washing blood off walls. And she looked at me like no mother should ever look at her son. The hatred in her eyes, the purse on her lips. As she said, you dirty SOB, do you know what you did to your dad last night? And I said, no. I go, where's dad? She said, he's out on the back deck. And I went out there, and that wasn't my dad on the back deck. That was a pound of hamburger with a cigarette sticking out of it. And she came out, and Mom started screaming at me and crying. She says, why do you keep hurting us? Why are you keep hurting us, Bob? My little sister pulled up, and my little sister was really hung over, and she looked at dad and she started screaming at me. She goes, why don't you just do the family a favor and die? Quit hurting us. And I will tell you that I had a epiphany that day. Maybe a spiritual awakening. Who knows? But I will tell you that day what hit me is that if you can't do it for yourself, for Christ's sakes, do it to protect your family from you. And I walked in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in that little town in Oregon City again, that Alano Club. And they had a three-cushion couch there. And I'm so ashamed and I'm so guilt-ridden. And I sit on the left-hand side of that three-cushion couch because the center cushion had a big hole in it. And this old gray-haired fart sit down on the other side of that cushion. They said, is anybody new here? And I raised my hand. I said, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. And towards the end of the meeting, they said, would the new guy Bob like to say something? And I started to share and I started to sob uncontrollably. The guilt and shame was coming out, pouring out of me. And the next thing I knew is that old guy that was sitting on the other side of the couch was now sitting on that hole in the center of the couch. And he put his arm around me because I couldn't say anything. I just sobbed. And he said, son, I hear what you can't say. And I looked over at this man and I could see the tears well up in his eyes. I could see the sincerity pouring out of him. And I felt, and he told me a little bit about himself, and I felt like it's described in Dr. Bob's Nightmare in the Big Book, right? Where Dr. Bob describes a June 10th, 1935 meeting with Bill W. And there's two sentences in there that really hit me. The first sentence is, and I can't paraphrase it exactly, but the first sentence says, here's a man that I talked to, the first person I talked to that actually knew about alcoholism from experience. And then second sentence is probably one of the most powerful ones that I've ever heard. And it said, here is a man that spoke my language. And right next to me, with his arm around me, with the tears of sincerity welled up in his eyes, and him telling me everything's going to be okay, here was that person. He was telling me about himself and about how embarrassed he was, so embarrassed that he couldn't put the key in his own door. Right? And I go, me too. And so I'd like to tell you that I just asked this guy to be my sponsor and started working the steps, and blue butterflies started flying out of me, right? Not the case. There she was. Girl of my dreams, right? And I just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I'm an alcoholic. When I get sicker and sicker and sicker, I get angrier and angrier and angrier. And it comes out sideways. And I had some conflict with the guy at one of our resorts and hurt him really bad. And I came back, headed back to town that day, jumped in my truck, and I go, here I am hurting people again. The next semi that comes along, I'm just going to speed up and turn the wheel and take him head on. And it'll be over. Semi would come, I couldn't turn the damn wheel. Next semi, I'm just going to speed up, I'm going to turn the wheel, I'm going to take him head on. This hurts too much. I don't know what to do. I have to quit hurting people. I know I can't drink. And my God, I can't stay sober. I'm going to commit suicide. And here come another semi. I couldn't turn the wheel. Now I'm in a real dilemma. I can't drink. I can't stay sober. And I can't even commit suicide. What the hell is going on here? Walked in that meeting in Oregon City and hear that old guy that was sitting on the couch next to me was. They called him Plumber Jim. You know, back then, most people had a nickname. He was a character, right? He's a union plumber. He always wore Levi's with the knees out. He always had flannel check shirts, arms out. He had three hairs growing out the top of his nose that he never shaved. And these suckers were long. And when he talked to you, he moved his head. And those hairs would move, right? And it looked like a snake with its tongue hanging out. You'd be going like that to Jim. And so I came in that meeting that day, and there Plumber Jim was. And he walked up to me, and he goes, would you like to have a cup of coffee afterwards? Now, normally I'd dodge that, but I'm so insane today that I said, yeah. And he went to a place, this restaurant, and he told me some more about himself. And I had heard about this sponsor, and I knew I needed help, right? I believe there's 7 magical words in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for me that are some of the most important words that I could possibly say. Those are, I need help, will you help me? And I sit there, and I wanted to scream those words at Plumber Jim. I need help, will you help me? I'm dying, I don't know what to do. And they just wouldn't come out of my mouth. Now, I'll tell you, Plumber Jim did one of the most important things and taught me a lesson that day. He asked me for his number. He asked me for my number, excuse me. But more important, he got my number because he knew damn well I wasn't going to call him. Right? And I got home that day, and all the way home, I'm looking for another semi. And I walked in my house that day. And the phone rang, and it was Plumber Jim. And he said, were you going to ask me to be your sponsor or what? And those 7 magic words came flying out of my mouth. I screamed through sobs. I need help. Will you help me? I'm going crazy. I can't stay drunk. I can't stay sober. You know, I can't commit suicide even. And he told me, I said, what do you want me to do? I want you as my sponsor. He says, for right now, I want you to do 2 things. He said, I want you not to drink. Actually, it's more than 2. He said, I want you to go to a lot of meetings. And don't drink or get married between meetings. I'd like to stand here tonight and tell you that I didn't drink. But, you know, it takes some of us a little longer than most. Anyway, we started on this journey called Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And we started to work in the steps. And he made me get this service position. Back then, you had real coffee cups in the meetings. So you had to wash all these coffee cups, right? And you had to wash them certain ways, right? Some of them you get real clean. But some of these gnarly old-timers, especially these old-timers that have been in the service, they like all the coffee stains in their cups, right? And I'm washing them out with a Brillo pad. I'm getting them nice and clean, and I'm pretty proud of myself, right? And these old-timers are giving me a ration of you-know-what. All right. They loved me enough to be kind to me on occasion, and they loved me enough to hurt my feelings on occasion. And that's what I needed. You know, my sponsors, we had a lot of 12-step meetings back then. My sponsor would call me up. He says, I'm going to be over in 10 minutes to pick you up. We've got a 12-step call. I'm going, I got a date. He's going, I don't care. I'll be over 10 minutes, get ready. I go over there, and we went on this one in what's called North Portland, which is really a rough area, and got this guy out of a motel, got him into what's called Hooper Detox over there, and I felt pretty good about myself, right? You know, here's the first one that I actually cured, right? And we're driving out of there, and I told my sponsor, I said, damn, that feels good. I said, I should offer to sponsor him. My sponsor had this old beat-up pickup, and he locked the brakes up on that pickup right in the four-way corner, looked at me, and he said, why in the hell would you want to screw his life up any worse than what it already is? I took that for not being ready to sponsor. But we went on and on and on, and we started there. And I will tell you that one of the hardest things for me to do was work the program with my family. That son of mine would not talk to me for the first 8 years I was sober. And I would send him a card all the time, and I'd see the same thing in the card. I'd say, I love you, son. When you're ready, I'll pay for the counseling. Let's go into counseling together. And I didn't hear from him for 8 years. And one day the phone rang, and I picked the phone up, and it was my son, and he was crying. And he said, Dad, I think I'm ready. And I went to the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And what did I do? And they said, you just show up. And I showed up at that counseling, and I heard things that I'd done. I heard the hatred coming out of his mouth. I felt lower than dirt. And I wanted to quit. My sponsor said, you quit, you find a new sponsor. And I kept going. I was 11 years sober, and my son, not more than that, 13 years sober, my son called me up and he said, Dad, I need you to come down to the hospital. And I went down to the hospital and I walked into this room, and he handed me my new baby granddaughter. And I'm holding this. I'm sitting on this couch, and my son's a big old boy. I'm sitting on this couch, and he goes, Dad, isn't she beautiful? I go, my God, she's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, right? And he put his arm around me and he kissed me on the cheek. And he said, I'm so glad to have you in my life, Dad. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you to the lovely ladies and men in the program of Al-Anon. Because I will tell you, they saved my butt. So I'm doing good, got that one healed, right? And I'm going, wow. And I met this gal. And we got married. And I'd like to tell you about this little lady. Her and I had same sobriety date, almost. She was 5 foot tall. She had a little pug nose. When she smiled, the skies opened up. Whether I was away from her for 5 minutes or 5 days, every time I seen her, she took my breath away. And we started life, had a big A marriage, right? Loved each other to death. Built a new retirement home. Moved into the new retirement home 1 month and found out she had terminal cancer. And we fought, she had ovarian cancer. We fought ovarian cancer for 7.5 years. Now, once again, the people and the lovely ladies in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous came in groves. They knew that how hard it was. And the women would come up from her women's group and they would say, "You're going fishing, Bob, with the guys, and get the hell away from us." And I'd come home from a couple days of fishing and I'm regenerated and she'd be all smiles and these women are just loving her to death. So I handed her a yellow tablet and I said, "Honey, let's do a bucket list. What do you want to do before you die?" Top of her bucket list is what the first thing. She'd like to live long enough to get her 20-year coin. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to her, right? She died a month after she got her coin. The other thing she wanted to do, she said, "I'd like to buy an RV, travel the United States. I've always wanted to do that," and we did. And she'd stop and get chemo here and there, and she'd be so sick from chemo. And I'd be so crazy from watching her hurt. And I pulled in a little place in a little tiny town in North Dakota. And it was just this little tiny town, right? She was sick. I was crazy. Parked the RV there. And I called. And there was a meeting that night in that town. And I walked in that meeting. And I broke down and sobbed. How sad I was. How much it hurt. How much I loved her. And they came to me. And the next morning, we heard a knock on the door of our RV. And here's all these people, men and women. And the men says, "Come on, we're taking you fishing. You said you liked to fish last night." And I said, "My wife's here." And the women goes, "Get the hell out of here." Right? Now, when I left that day with those guys, I was crazy and she was sick. When I got home that night, I felt good, and she was sitting outside in a lawn recliner, had a pedicure, a manicure, lipstick on, that smile that opened up the sky, and these women were taking care of her. And I went, "Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous." The only thing I had to do was go to a meeting, find a meeting, and be honest with what I'm going through. I don't have to, you know. I'm not one of them that will go to a meeting and tell you I'm fine when I'm not. The fact of the matter is, I was dying. And we did that, and we came back home. And I used to sit there, and I'd watch her comb huge balls of hair out of her head from the chemo as she was talking to one of what she calls her girls about gratitude. And she'd have her bucket to get sick in and her comb. You know. And then I woke up one morning and she was gone. And I got to tell you, I thought my world was over. I don't know if I'd ever hurt that much in my entire life. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous came in groves once again. You know, they helped me barrier. They told me the next right thing. They brought me so damn many Costco cherry pies, I still hate them. But they loved me to death. They loved me to death. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about my amends process with my family. Because once again, for me, the family was the hardest thing that I could work on. How long have we been going? 10 minutes? Okay. Anyway, the hardest thing is me working with my family, right? And my son had a problem other than alcohol. And I was able to, you know, lead him to some people I knew in NA, because I'm too close, I can't work with my family. I gotta go get somebody else. You know, he's got 20 years off of it now. My daughter, stepdaughter, she was the daughter of my wife that died of cancer. By the time she was 16, or I should say, by the time she was 13, we'd had her in four treatment centers. By the time she was 15, she'd overdosed three times, flatlined three times. By the time she was 16, she was a runaway. And hadn't seen her for a couple years. And I was up in North Portland looking at a job one day, and I looked up on the corner, and here's a prostitute. I looked up there, and I, that looks like my daughter. And I drove up there, and it was my daughter. And she said, get the hell away from me. You know, I don't want your AA crap. I said, would you at least have lunch with me? And I kept finding, I knew where she worked now, that area. I kept going up there and finding her and bugging her about, at least have lunch with me. And we bought, had the first lunch, and she showed up. Face is black and blue because her pimp pistol whipped her so bad. I am not the kind of guy that you do that to my daughter. I'll just put it that way. But she told me, she said, Dad, if you kill him, when I need you, you'll be locked up. And I knew she was right. So I just kept having lunch. And I kept talking to her about going back to college. And she'd go, Dad, I'm too stupid to go back to college, right? And the ladies in Al-Anon said, you keep after her. And I kept doing it, right? And one day she said, you know, just to get you off my butt, I'll take one college credit. And she took one at college credit, right? And she aced the class. And she looked at me and she said, Dad, can you help me get cleaned up? And I think I could do this. Right? She's got 18 years now. Yeah. She went back to school 10 years ago. I sit at Portland Memorial Coliseum, crying like a baby, watching her get her master's degree. She's now the director of a battered women's shelter in Portland. All right. My granddaughter, I have a 21-year-old granddaughter. She's studying to be a veterinarian, and she is the love of my life. Every Friday, doesn't matter what, every Friday I get the same text from her. And the text goes, Grandpa, if nobody's told you how much they love you today, I want to be the first. And 2 years ago, we were down at the coast, and she sat down on the couch next to me, and I felt water dropping on my arm. And I looked over at her, and she had tears running down her eyes. I said, what's the matter, baby? She said, Grandpa, what does it mean? What does it look like when you drink too much? Why can't you just skip a generation, for God's sakes? And I said, I can't help you. I can't answer that question for you, baby. I said, but I'm going to have a woman call you that can help you answer that question. I'm too close. The only thing I'll do is make a mess. And I got some of those lovely ladies, lovely dignified ladies of Alcoholics Anonymous, to call my baby. Last month, I gave her a 2-year chip. Right. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, this God that put in my life along the way. My mom died of cancer, and I'm mama's boy. The last thing that I ever talked to my mom about, she was laying on her hospice bed, and before she went into coma, we used to talk about different topics. I'd sit by her bedside, and so I went in, and the last time I ever talked to her, I go, Mom, what would you like to talk about today? She said, I'd like to talk about gratitude, Bob. And I looked at this little lady that now weighed 90 pounds, and my first thought was, what in the hell do you have to be grateful for? And so I asked her, I said, what are you grateful for, Mom? And she put this little frail hand up on the side of my face and stroked it gently. And she said, I'm so grateful I get to die before you, Bob. That's where our disease takes us. How many times did my mom wait up for a phone call? After all those years, she was grateful that she gets to die before me. So I got it all healed, right? I'm getting things healed. But I'll tell you, I got a secret. I got a secret, and I'm not sharing it with nobody. My sponsor knows it. But I'm not sharing the meeting because it may make me look bad. Right? My secret was I still hated my dad. And I still wanted to do some bad stuff to Dad. And he owned a big part of my brain. And I was going back on a horseback trip. We're back in the wilderness area. And my sponsor said, good, you're taking your dad. And I go, the hell I am. He says, you don't take your dad, you find a new sponsor. He used to tell me that shit all the time. And so I took Dad, right? And Dad's 80 years old, riding a damn horse in front of me. And I'm praying to God. Because you told me to pray to God to ask for miracles. I'm going, God, would you allow a rock to roll down that hill and kill Dad? And we'd go a ways further, and I'd go, God, would you strike that tree down and fall across that horse and kill Dad? No rock, no tree. We get back into our camp, and I'm crazy. I'm sitting at this most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life. It's 200 feet down. I'm sitting on the edge of the cliff. My legs are dangling off the edge of the cliff. Sun is coming up. I'm talking to God. What the hell am I supposed to do here? And I hear the gravel shuffle behind me, and I glance back, and here Dad is. I go, there's a sign. God wants me to push him off this cliff. And he plops his ass down on the cliff next to me, right? And there's dead silence. And all suddenly I heard a sniff. And then I heard another sniff. And I looked over at this little old gray-haired fart. And he had big tears running down his eyes. And he said, if I only had it to do over again, son, I'm so sorry. And I'd gone to too many meetings, and I'd worked too many steps. I talked to God too many times. And instead of pushing him off the cliff, I reached over and I put my arm around him, and I pulled his little fuzzy head in next to my shoulder. I turned over there, and I gave him a kiss on the head. And I said, Dad, what about if we start over right now? And he looked up at me, and he says, you think we can? And I said, let's give it a shot. And we had the next 16 years with my dad. Now, I was coming up on a podium a lot like this to speak at Sherry's meeting up in Hermiston. They have big oyster feed up in Hermiston, 600 people, right? And I'm talking up there, and I get a call from my sister prior to going on the podium. And she said, Dad's really bad. I'm taking him to the hospital. I said, keep me posted. I'm just getting close to getting on stage, right? And she calls me up. She says, Bob, Dad's really bad. And I said, I'm walking off stage right now, and I'm going to fly home. And she turned to my dad, and she said, Bobby's coming home. Now, my dad, I had got my dad involved with my buddies in AA and stuff, and he loved to sit around and tell some war stories around a campfire to my buddies, right? And he seen me work with new people. The last word I ever heard my dad say was, you tell Bob to stay there and talk to those new people. They need him worse than I do. And I took that stage that night, and my dad died while I was speaking. You know. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to close with one other little thing. I've talked long enough. I moved to a different area. From Portland area over to Central Oregon. And I hated their AA over there. You know, I had 25 years sober over in the valley, right? Now I'm moving over here and their AA sucked. And I bitched to my sponsor constantly. And he said, you go find a service position. And it's not going to be an AA. I went, what? He said, you used to destroy society. How about doing some service for it? So he called this gal he knew that ran what's called the family kitchen in Bend, right? Cooking for the homeless. And I started making noon meals for the homeless. And never thought much about it, but one day this lady walked in, and she was tattered. She had different colored tennis shoes on. But now, holding her hand was the most beautiful little blonde-headed girl that I had ever met in my life. And her name was Lily. And she had little ringlets, right? A face like an angel. And I used to make her what was called Big Bob's special sandwiches. A little peanut butter, a little jelly, a little sugar, a glass of milk. She'd come in every day and she'd tug on my apron, right? And she'd go, "Are you going to make me one of Big Bob's special sandwiches?" I go, "Yeah, a little more peanut butter, a little more jelly, a little bit of sugar, glass of milk." And that went on for a while, and I absolutely fell in love with this little girl. God, she was precious, right? She used to walk up to me after she ate her sandwich. She'd go, and I'd bend over to her, and she'd kiss me on the cheek, right? And her mom came in one day, and she said, we're leaving for San Francisco. I went, "Really?" I said, she said, "My folks live down there." I go, "What are you going to do in San Francisco?" She said, "Lily has cancer, and she's dying." I went, how could somebody that young and that precious? And they moved to San Francisco. And a few months passed, and I got a letter, card, in the mail. It showed up at the family kitchen there. And it was a card from her mother. And she said in this card, she says, "I have no idea who you are. I have no idea who showed you what you gave us." She says, "I have no idea how you could love us and not even know us. I have no idea what you did, how you did what you did for our family." She said, one of the last things that Lily said was, "I sure wish I had one of Big Bob's sandwiches." Thank you, AA.